Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Jan Hayes is a professor emeritus of educational leadership, I beg your pardon. We have different divisions here under the College of Education and Behavioral Science. She's a professor emeritus of educational leadership at MTSU. Her husband, Dean Hayes, is the track coach here, who has made several sojourns in search far and wide around the world of great track talent for this university. And on one of those travels, Dr. Hayes discovered a traditional Japanese folktale, which she has turned into her first children's book. It's called The Split-Tongued Sparrow, a traditional Japanese folktale, and it is illustrated by Bobby Dawson of Franklin, Tennessee. The illustrations are just gorgeous. This is one of the few times I regret that this is radio, because I can't show you how pretty the pictures are. But Dr. Hayes is here today with us to tell us all about the book. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a nice day to be inside. Yeah, it's so warm.
It certainly is. Before we get into this sweet little story here, which is written, there's haiku in it, and the Japanese characters are also written on the sides of the pages, and we'll get to describing the book in greater detail in a minute. But let's talk about first how you found out about this little story.
I was coming back from China, where my husband and some of his colleagues were working with Chinese potential Olympians. And I had to return early to the United States for professional activities. And on my way back, I flew from Beijing to Osaka. And one of my former students, Suko, actually lived in Osaka. So she met me for supper. And I'd had her in a course called Books and Media for Children. My student about the her favorite folk tales, and she told me two. This was one of the two that she told me about, and I thought it was such a beautiful story because it was about kindness, and it seemed so typical of her country that I asked her to just write the story down. Well, she was much more comfortable writing in the Japanese kanji than she was in English. So she wrote the story out in Japanese, and I brought it back, and it stayed in my file folder for years. I told my friend Dr. Esther Seaman about it, and she said, "Oh, you must publish that book." She knew I taught the children's literature. So I promised her that I would get to it only if she would translate the story back into English for me, which she did. It was very loosely translated, so it's really an adapted version of their original folktale. I started out this story in haiku and ended it in haiku, because haiku is a form of poetry that comes from Japan. And this book is about nature as well as is haiku. When I wrote it, I just felt so good about it that I took it to the president at Omoore College, who is another former student. And they have their own press. And he said, "Oh, let our press publish it."
Omoore is in Franklin.
Yeah, it's the Omoore College of Design. And they have all kinds of art departments. And I said, if they were willing to do it, I would rather than illustrate it myself, I would like one of their students or recent graduates to do the illustrations, if that student would let me work with them, and that all of the proceeds would go back to Omoore College. He thought, of course, that was a wonderful idea. He put me in touch with an editor by the name of Paula Bagnall, and she got excited about it and talked to several students, and she selected one. And I was able to meet with this student, Bobby Dawson, and he gave me some sample illustrations that he had done from other things, other work he had done. And I was so pleased with it that I gave him some sketches of objects and kimonos and things like that that I had drawn when I was in Japan as a visitor. As I was looking at the book, Bobby had incorporated all of those things into his wonderful illustrations in this book.
And all the money goes to Omor.
Yes.
You're not making a dime off of this.
No, not a penny, but that's not why I did it. And it's such a beautiful story for children.
What is kanji? Is it a dialect of Japanese? Is that how you would describe it?
All I know is that it's the characters. It may be. I don't know. I use the word because the wife of one of my former students, it pays to have students, I'll tell you, wonderful students, a young woman by the name of Ari Redfern, actually agreed to translate it back, what I had written, to translate that back into Japanese, and she called these characters kanji, and that's where I came up with the words kanji.
Had you ever taught young children before? I know that you have taught college students here for years, but you have not taught children the age for which this book would be most appealing?
Yes, I have.
How? When's that?
I graduated in teacher education with majors in English and elementary education from the University of Minnesota many, many years ago. So I taught first in Minneapolis. Then I moved with my husband to a Chicago suburb and taught fourth graders there. And then I moved with him here to Murfreesboro, and here I taught sixth grade. And in between, I've taught special education. And I'm currently tutoring a young elementary boy who's autistic. So I have a lot of years of teaching.
Not to mention your own children, I'm sure.
Right.
So just to set this up, there is this sweet little sparrow who sings and sings, and there are two ladies, one of whom is a happy lady who appreciates the sparrow's sweet songs, and a rather grumpy lady who finds the songs to be somewhat irritating, and the conflict proceeds from that point, if you want to pick up the story from there.
Well, it starts out with haiku, a small brown sparrow, sitting in cherry blossoms, sings a happy song. And as the two women are listening, one finds the singing delightful, and the other one is not happy with the sound. So the sparrow is carefully taken care of by the very happy old woman, who actually finds the little sparrow near death, and she nurses him and cares for him. And he sings to her all the time. The unhappy old woman found the little sparrow eating her starch for her laundry, and because that's how she made a living. And she was not at all happy about it. So she took her scissors and she actually cut the tongue of the little brown sparrow. And the little sparrow flew away and was not seen or heard from for a long time.
That was the heartbreak. I mean, I'm sitting here, at my age, I'm reading a children's book, and I'm actually heartbroken at that point. I mean, I really was. Go ahead.
Well, the very kind old woman missed the little sparrow so much that she went looking for him and actually went to the mountains and called for him. "Where are you, little split-tongued sparrow?" And when the sparrow heard the woman's voice, he started to sing once more, and his song actually came with her smile. He invited her to have supper with him, And after the meal was done, he said, "You will have food as long as you can hear my song." He offered the woman, the kind old woman, two baskets and told her that she would never want for food again. One of the baskets was large and the other was very small. Well, the kind old woman knew she had a long, long way back to her little house. So she picked up the small basket and carried it back to her home. When she looked in, she found gold and silver and jewels and rolls of beautiful silk. And that little old woman became a very rich woman. But she still missed the little brown sparrow. Her unhappy neighbor saw what she had received from that sparrow, and she was very jealous because she worked hard at her laundry to make her living. And she said, "I must know where that sparrow lives." So the kind old woman told the unhappy woman where to find the little sparrow. And the unhappy woman journeyed to the mountains a long way away. She left her little house and she left her laundry to look for the sparrow. "Where are you, little sparrow with the split tongue?" she called. And she found a mountain where the little sparrow lived. At that point, no song came from the sparrow, but he did set the table for her and offered her a meal. After the meal was over, once again the sparrow offered two baskets, a very small basket and a very large one. Well, the unhappy old woman saw what came from the small basket of her neighbor and looked at the big basket, and she said, "I want the heavy basket." Now, it was very hard for her to carry because she had a long way to go, but she did carry it back home. And as soon as she got into her little house, she opened up the top of the basket, and out flew monsters with split tongues. They screeched at the unhappy old woman, and they pecked off her ears. She waved her broom at them to get those little monsters out of the house, and they did fly out. Now the unhappy old woman still does laundry, still hangs it on the line, and the happy old woman still grows flowers, which she takes to the market, even though she doesn't have to do that. And the little split-tongued sparrow comes and sings to her. The small brown sparrow still sits in cherry blossoms, singing happily, but only the kind old woman now hears his song.
You tell it so beautifully. I mean, you really ought to make an audio book out of this.
Well, thank you. I'm a storyteller, and I go to schools and do storytelling, and I do workshops on storytelling. So I thank you for that.
Have you considered going to Linebaugh to read it to the little kids?
No, I haven't. I thought I'd wait to see if I get an invitation.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the polite thing to do, but you've got my endorsement for what little that may be worth. You said that you made sketches for Bobby, the illustrator. Did you ever consider illustrating it yourself? Did you not think you were that good an artist?
Well, that was my first thought, but I really wanted to give a student an opportunity to have something for a portfolio, to get a student in particular who might be interested in illustrating children's books. And I did have confidence in myself. I have written with Mrs. Jane Poole three books for teachers, and I did all the illustrations for those. So those were professional books, and did all the illustrations. So it was more altruistic. I wanted to help a student and the college.
And the colors are very, very vivid. It's a perfect birthday or Christmas present for anyone. And if you had to tell someone what the moral of the story is, how would you phrase it?
Well, as I've done a couple of books signings already, and I say that kindness always pays. And of course, the nature, the beauty of nature comes through in the illustrations that Bobby did. I think he's probably done a much better job illustrating than I could do.
Do you want to do more children's books?
Well, I have the second story that I brought back from Japan, and I'm just not ready. I want to see how this one works before I try working that one up.
Is this a refreshing change of pace for you from all the academic writing that you did throughout your career in higher education?
Well, writing a children's book was really harder.
Really?
Being very succinct and being descriptive and still painting a picture with the words.
Without dumbing it down or going over their heads.
Yes, and at the same time, maintaining the culture. One of the things that the translator, Ari Redfern, told me when she read my words, that in Japan there is no such expression as set the table. And she didn't know how to translate that back into the kanji. And I said, well, you know English. What would you say in Japanese? And she said, well, why, I'd say prepared the food.
Okay.
And so I said, that's what I want you to put in the translation. Because the translation, if you look in the very back of the book, there are three pages of translation of the book. I want it to reflect the English words, but also the culture of Japan.
So if a person who was fluent in the Japanese language and the Japanese culture were to pick this up and read it, he or she would find it consistent with the Japanese culture instead of looking at it and going, oh, well, there go the Americans again. They put it through their filter, but they haven't really captured the essence of it.
Well, and that's exactly what I wanted to happen. I wanted the story to represent the Japanese culture. So some of the illustrations, the sketches that I had drawn that Bobby included were the cherry trees, the kimonos of the women. You'll see that he's included the appropriate kinds of flowers, put a mountain in the background, of course, the mountains of Japan, and the small table with the short legs, you can see that. So there are a number of characteristics that are true to the Japanese culture that are continued. I asked a couple of friends who speak Japanese to look it over, and they said, oh, I know this story. And they felt good about it. One thing Bobby added to the illustrations that are so different is that on the cover, down the upper right-hand side, you'll see the title in Japanese.
Very, very, it's a little bit faint, but it's very tastefully and classily done over on the right-hand side on the front cover.
And it says split-tongued sparrow. Then if you look at each page, on in the bottom of each page on the side, you'll find the title is included on each page.
And of course, it's written as the Japanese language.
Yes.
Is it straight up and down in a column, as opposed to we read English left to right.
Yes.
You've got more, or at least one more, Japanese folk tale to tell. Would you like to turn this into a cottage industry and do American folk tales and really branch out with it?
I really hadn't thought about that, Gina. It's a possibility. As a storyteller, I love rewriting and restating stories. So I just hadn't thought about it. In my spare time, you mean?
Do you have any spare time?
Well, I'm a traveler. Yeah. And one of the reasons I retired, that's emeritus, is so that I could travel. And I'm going to Poland next week. And then in, and I hope to find a folk tale or two there. Then I'm going to Beijing in August for the Olympics.
Yes.
And then in September, I'm going back to Europe to cruise the Danube. So we'll see if I can't find some more stories.
Do you accompany Coach Hayes on all his recruiting trips, or do you embark on some of these travels without Coach Hayes?
I often go by myself or with my daughters, and when he invites me mm-hmm. on a trip, I go with him. And he's taken me, of course, to China and to England and Italy. So I've been in Athens, Greece, a couple of times. So. Sometimes I get to go with him, and sometimes I go by myself or with my daughters.
You could bring tales back from every country you've ever visited.
Well, I ask people. I always ask them about folk tales. My daughter and I were cruising the Nile, and I asked a gentleman there about folk tales, and he was an Egyptian, but he couldn't think of any folk tales. And I went into a bookstore to see what I could find, and I really couldn't find any folk tales that were available in that particular bookstore. So I have to do some digging and see what else I can find.
Okay, there's a new challenge for you. Talk to Alan Hibbert over at the Middle East Center.
And, right.
He could probably point you, since he's an English professor, too, he could probably point you in a good direction. This pertains to the Olympic Games in Beijing. You've already been to Beijing, and one of the big concerns about the upcoming Olympics is whether or not the athletes will be able to perform at peak level in the quality of air that exists there, which is heavily polluted. They're really, yes. really struggling with that. Did you find it difficult to breathe when you were there?
When we were there, people did not have vehicles. The communist officials had vehicles, and everyone had bicycles. So that was in 1989. So there was very little pollution at that time. Now there are so many industries around Beijing, and so many people have cars. I'm sure the pollution is horrible. I understand that the government, a month before the games start, which will be about now, is going to shut down all the industry and hope to clear the air.
I hasten to say about now as we tape, as you hear this, we are taping in June as opposed to the air date. But it was something that really my mind went totally flashed on that particular aspect of it when you said Beijing. And when you said just now, 1989, that was the year of Tiananmen Square.
Yes, we were the first group of Westerners to go to China after Tiananmen Square.
How long after Tianmen Square was
it? It was, let's see, we went in July, and that was what, in April?
Mm-hmm. I believe it was. When the young man stood in front of the tank.
Yes. And we were a little reticent about it, but they took us immediately from the plane to the U.S. Embassy to brief us on our behavior and what we should and shouldn't do. But as we were walking down the steps of the plane, at the bottom of the steps were two soldiers with the big AK-47s and little books flipping through to see if our pictures were in those books. On every block, there were numerous soldiers with their guns. Nobody took a misstep at that time. But there was a little tension in the air. They would not let us visit Tiananmen Square. They drove past it in the bus that they had for us.
Was it totally blocked off to all vehicular traffic, or was it just you, because you were Americans, that you were not allowed to
No
be there?
One was allowed to go there. And they especially did not want us to visit. And no incidents or problems were going to exist with these coaches.
Well, I remember watching on television that very night. CBS broke into Dallas, as a matter of fact. And of course, the drama was far more compelling than anything JR had to offer, especially because it was real. But I remember the great confrontation as the developing story continued and progressed between the Chinese officials and CBS, especially Dan Rather, trying to get them to pull the plug and take it off the air because they did not want the West to see what was going on. So given all of that, how did you obtain permission to go in the first place, or had this been set up before Tiananmen Square happened?
It had been set up in advance, and the coaches were, well, the athletic officials, athletics means track and field, mm-hmm. around most of the world,
right.
had asked my husband to put together a group of coaches to work with potential Olympians. And so it had all been set up, but they were very careful and everything was done just right. I want to tell you that wherever we walked, and in parks, people would come up and pull on our clothes, and those that could speak English, and they'd say, "Why are you here? Don't you know what's happened?" And that even happened in a store where I was. Several of us went to the store to look at merchandise, and the electricity went out, and a woman was one of the clerks, came up, and she tapped me on the shoulder and said, why are you here? Don't you know what's happened?" I said, "Yes, it's been on television. The whole world knows." And she said, "Be sure you go back and tell everybody."
So that's what that was all about. They were wanting you to spread the word. It wasn't that she was concerned for your safety so much as it was she wanted somebody to get the message out.
Yes. The people there didn't realize that
right.
the world knew about what had happened.
Because, of course, they can't get CBS, and it wasn't on Chinese TV.
Mm-hmm. But the people were so not... And the officials with us, everyone was so kind and so considerate and so gracious. And they were happy to see us there.
I think, after an incident like that, one would want to put one's best foot forward.
Mm-hmm. and we did get to go to schools. I had, with my luggage, I had packed a number of English books, American books, for children. And two of the wives were college professors, and so they took us to schools and colleges and universities, but I took these books to the schools for the children because they are teaching them English.
So this will go over well in Japan.
I hope so.
Yes. In the schools there, that would be an interesting thing for the Japanese schools to adopt a book written by an American about a Japanese folktale.
Yes.
this is something that if one were your grandchild, I would think it would be considered an heirloom. Do you think about what this will mean to your grandchildren and their children and their children?
No, I don't. I have two daughters who tell me they're professional women and they aren't going to have children.
Oh, I see.
But they love books, and they told me that they wanted a copy immediately when it came out. And I've heard from both of them, they've received their copies and they love them. So they're going to share them with children that come to visit, but I won't have grandchildren.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm an aunt. I have two nephews. They're terrific. I mean, they're too old for the split-tongue sparrow, mm-hmm. but they... Oh.
And folk tales really represent the various cultures. If you were to look at Norwegian folk tales, the harshness of the land and the crisp language comes through, and the softness of the Japanese culture comes through here with the soft lilting sound of the language. So,
well, given your husband's profession, it would be nice if you could get a Kenyan folktale or a Ghanaian folktale and incorporate his profession into your books. You make it about the little Kenyan boy who runs all over the mountains barefoot in preparation for fulfilling his Olympic dream or something like that.
I had never even thought about that. That's a great idea because he brings athletes from Africa and from France, from Europe, to compete. And I just never thought about sitting down and asking them folk tales, which I should do.
They must have heard them growing up.
Oh, I'm sure they have.
I mean, you know, they've probably heard more about Kip Kano than they've heard about
right.
You know, they're politicians. This is The Split-Tongued Sparrow. It's a delightful children's book published by O'More Publishing of Franklin, Tennessee. The illustrator is Bobby Dawson, and the author is Dr. Jan Hayes, Professor Emeritus of Educational Leadership, MTSU. Thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Jenna Logue. This is MTSU On the Record. Join us again at this same time next Sunday. Catch us at mtsunews.com at your leisure, and of course, remember, we're also on iTunes.